start by acknowledging the colleagues whose work I'm using and many places.
I was told that it's, I have to push one of the buttons to get this lamp to go away, but.
There they are.
So.
Okay, so I want to start out with some philosophy since everybody else has done that along the way. Talk a little bit about why build general circulation models. And this was sparked by the comment from Ian James's book that was mentioned at the beginning of the meeting. One reason, obviously, is practical applications in the matter of prediction. So we do weather forecasting. And nowadays, even seasonal to interannual prediction operationally using global atmospheric models, coupled ocean models, and climate change simulations, IPCC, of course, very much in the news recently. So there are these engineering-style applications of the models in which they're needed by outside communities to do things. But we also have what we can call academic applications. One category would be numerical experiments, and here I'll just mention, refer back to what Isaac showed us early in the week. Idealized experiments try to understand basic relationships between processes. And then synthesis. And this is something that I'm going to try to emphasize in this talk, that global model obviously includes everything. And so in the process of trying to put together a global model that reproduces important things that we see in nature, we are forced to couple processes that are very often studied in isolation. And that effort to couple immediately raises lots of interesting questions, and we find ourselves in the course of building the models trying to solve these questions that arise. And so you can think of the model from an academic point of view as being a machine for generating problems that we work on. And we spend a lot of our time doing exactly this. And then, of course, potentially, we could imagine that the model is a mechanism for forging interdisciplinary connections within our small but nevertheless very broad subdiscipline of atmospheric science. So from that point of view, picking up on that last thought, we can think of the GCM as a kind of scientific waterhole where various parties working in atmospheric science and also, of course, applied mathematics get together and communicate and cross-fertilize and so on. And
being here in L.A., it's good it's not a tar pit.
This is the LeBron. just to think about who those communities are, we have, of course, within our discipline various types of models. We have the global models, which I'm going to be talking about mostly here. We have the cloud resolving models, which we've heard quite a bit about earlier in the week, and which have become very active, widely used tools within our field in the last 20 years or so. And then, of course, large eddy simulation, which was actually pioneered back in the late 60s, early 70s by Jim Dearborn and others. So there's this range of models, and actually each of these has its own community. So we can think about groups of people classified in this way. So the GCM people, I'll say, are Rossby Wave people. That's an oversimplification.
Oh, boy.
Thunderstorm people, and maybe we can include tropical cyclone people here in the middle somewhere. And then turbulence people down in the large eddy simulation.
What are we to infer from the colors and the people?
I didn't choose the colors, the slide.
The hot colors are
you can ask him. But there is, in fact, a disconnect at the waterhole because what the cloud observers measure, and obviously I'm going to be talking about a lot about clouds here, general circulation models don't simulate. So somebody goes out in an airplane and measures something passing through a cloud system and wants to check the model to see if the model agrees with that measurement. Well, the model doesn't even produce a number that corresponds to the measurement. So there's a problem there. In addition, similarly, what the cloud resolving models simulate is to a large extent what these people measure, but the GCMs don't simulate it. So once again, you have a kind of disconnect. And this is something that we could wish to address. And there are at least two ways to do that. Now, the way that has been used a lot up to now, and which is important and will continue to be used, is explained in this diagram, which I don't want to explain in detail, it's too complicated. But this is a diagram invented by Christian Jacob, who's now at the Australian Met Service. And it's basically a diagram that shows how general circulation models are improved over time. So you can imagine the model is used in numerical weather prediction or climate simulation. Some problems are identified. The model doesn't produce So then you go to the field data and you select some case studies. So it's a case in which the phenomenon question appears and which the suitable data exists. You then perform case studies using single column models, let's say the physical parameterizations extracted from the model in the same sense that Andy was talking about in the previous talk, or cloud resolving models. Both of those can be brought to bear here. So now we've brought together the observationalist, the cloud resolving modelers, and the general circulation modeler. So we do have a kind of water hole here. And on the basis of these studies, we then try to design model improvements. And of course, this is the hard part. And so you can think of that American scientist cartoon where it says, at this point, a miracle occurs. That's what happens in here. So you somehow arrive at a model improvement and put that back in the model. And around we go. And this is the machine we use to improve the models over time. This is very real now for about the last 15 years or so. This has been going on. But we can also imagine a second approach, which I'm calling here, since I grew up in the 60s, harmonic convergence of general circulation models and cloud resolving models. And that, of course, is where superparameterization comes in and where global cloud resolving models come in. So I'm going there, but before I get to that, let me give you a list of lamentations. These are problems with current cloud parameterizations, by no means an exhaustive list, but just two important categories. First of all, we, in the course of cloud parameterization, are of course trying to calculate statistics. We're not trying to predict the individual clouds. We're trying to describe the statistical properties of large collections of clouds. And that includes the dynamical processes going on. So for example, the updraft mass flux or the updraft velocities, perhaps. Many other things. And in fact, these statistics and how they are controlled are inadequately understood. It's not to say we don't know anything about it, but we don't know enough about it. So we have problems with what we call our closures that determine the intensity of the cloud dynamical activity. We have problems with triggering. So here the question would be, you know, does the relative humidity in the boundary layer have to be at least 80% before I can get a deep cloud or not? And problems with mesoscale organization, which of course is very ubiquitous in the real atmosphere, but is almost entirely absent in cloud parameterizations used in general circulation models. Microphysics, which Wojtek mentioned earlier in the week, is very rudimentary in all general circulation models. We have made some progress, at least the models include something here, but it's nowhere near good enough. And one of the reasons that it's not good enough is that in fact the required input, the numbers you need to do cloud microphysics, things like local updraft speeds, are really not available. The general circulation models don't predict those numbers. In addition, of course, there are issues of basic understanding, especially for ice clouds, as Wojtek mentioned. So we can imagine disparate communities, including applied mathematicians, working together over time to solve this cloud problem. And that would include atmospheric scientists as well. But let's step back a little bit and think about how models have evolved since they were first constructed back in the 60s. I started working in this field as a graduate student back in 72, right across the street. And there haven't been any really revolutionary changes in the models, and the climate models especially, since the 1970s. The models that we were learning then and the models that we're learning now are not all that different, especially for climate. But over the same period of time, computing power has increased by about a factor of a million. We've gone from a few megaflops in the basement of the math science building to now a few teraflops. And I remember the Cray 1. I'm sure many of you here remember when the Cray 1 was introduced back in 76, 77. And this is the cover of a brochure that was available about that time. I still have this brochure in my filing cabinet. Found it fascinating. Read about this amazing machine with very, very fast and a million words of memory. That's 8 megabytes. It was spectacular at the time, but of course it's, and the name Cray still has a certain cachet, there's the C, but in fact this little thing is about 3 times faster than a Cray 1, and it has 256 times as much memory, and it costs less. So we've moved on beyond this, but the models we're running today are very nearly the same as the models we were running on this. And there's actually good reason for this. Because back in the days of the Cray 1, what was called a climate simulation was just an atmosphere model with some simple land surface model, no ocean. And it was run for, let's say, a perpetual January, 100 simulated days, something like that. That was called climate simulation. And of course, today we run not only centuries, but ensembles of century simulations with coupled models that are somewhat more complex. And so a lot of the additional computer power has gone to extend the lengths of the runs. But we don't need to do that again. You don't need another factor of 1,000 in the length of the runs if what you're interested in, for example, is anthropogenic climate change. So we can think now about using the coming increases in computing power, the ones that we're going to see over the next decade or two, to increase the resolution of the models and perhaps to make them simpler in some respects, not more complicated. So at very high resolution, as we know, a model should grow individual clouds. But general circulation models don't use the equations that you need to describe the growth and decay of individual clouds. They use equations that describe the growth and decay of ensembles of clouds. So this brings us to the subject of cloud resolving models, which have already been talked about earlier in the week by Wojtek, among others. And so the idea is we solve partial differential equations and out come clouds. And this is, in fact, a simulation done by my colleague Murat Karutinov at CSU. The domain here is 150 kilometers on a side, and the horizontal resolution is 100 meters. And there are 256 layers in the vertical. So if you do the arithmetic, it's approximately 500 million grid cells. So very expensive calculation. Simulated a portion of a day over the Amazon basin. And this picture was made by Ray Grayson. Here's an animation from the same calculation showing the movement of larger cloud blobs and the growth and decay of smaller things down here. You can see it looks remarkably realistic, and there's a very wide range of spatial scales, even with this relatively small domain. But as we know, cloud resolving models have lots of limitations. So for example, microphysics, as summarized in these two cartoons on the left, still has to be parameterized in these models. We have to worry about what the little drops are doing, and it's very important. Turbulence and shallow convection must still be parameterized because, unlike the model I just showed you with its delta x of 100 meters, the cloud-resolving models that are used in super-parameterization and related work that I'll talk about in a few minutes typically have horizontal grid spacings on the order of about 3 or 4 kilometers. And so turbulence definitely has to be parameterized, and the smaller convective clouds are not resolved. And, of course, radiative transfer still has to be parameterized. But, in fact, these same points can be viewed as strengths of the cloud resolving models because, well, first of all, this repeats what Wojtek said earlier in the work in the week, that with a cloud resolving model, cloud system resolving model, mesoscale and cloud scale dynamics, at least for the larger clouds, are explicitly simulated so that microphysics, turbulence, and radiation become the tall pegs. And I put microphysics first on purpose. This type of model is a much better framework for microphysics parameterization because it gives you the information that you need to use what you think you know about microphysical processes. Again, things like local updraft speeds. It's also a much better framework for turbulence parameterization because, for example, if you can simulate the individual updrafts of the larger clouds, you can see the shear on the side of the updraft, which is provides a mechanism for generating turbulence there. And other things too. So if you're trying to do turbulence parameterization, this is a much better framework. Cloud resolving models, much better framework than a GCM. And it's also a much better framework for radiation parameterization because things like cloud overlap in the vertical come out explicitly and don't have to be dealt with by crude assumptions. So we can dream about a global cloud resolving model, GCRM, and back of the envelope calculation, which I won't take time to go through in detail here, leads you to the conclusion that such a model will require about a million times more computer power than today's model to do the same type of calculation. So for example, if you wanted to do century-long climate simulation with a GCRM, you'd need ballpark a million times more computer power than doing the same calculation with today's climate. But this type of model is no longer a dream, as I think probably most of you know. Our friends at the Frontier Research Center for Global Change the same way that Toyota helped General Motors during the 70s.
So our future doesn't look so good.
You don't need a visa. Anyway, dream no more. And this is not a satellite picture, as you can guess from the fact that it's actually in the pretty daylight. All of it's part of the sphere you can see, but this is a simulation done with the 3.5 kilometer mesh on the Earth simulator by Hiroaki Miura and colleagues over at the Frontier Project. And you can see, beautifully organized cloud systems here, including funnel systems in the mid-latitudes, but the amount of detail in the simulation is far beyond the amount of detail you can see in this picture. So in fact, this has become a reality now, though a very expensive reality, and it's really just a test bed. I think that's the way we should think about this. It's going to become a tool that we can use for practical things later. Right now, it's something we experiment with, and it's about the same kind of thing that a conventional jump circulation model was back in the early 60s, let's say. So this model, again, there's a lot of detail on this slide, which I don't want to go through, but it consumes roughly one teraflop day per simulated day. In other words, if you get one real teraflop for a whole day, you can simulate one day with this. So it's very expensive. This slide, which I took from Akio Arakawa, shows some of the important differences between global cloud resolving model and a conventional GCM. What you should look at mostly are these large boxes in the center of the two diagrams. Here, for the conventional model, you have a parameterization of deep convection and shallow convection and congested convection and so on. A parameterization of stratiform cloud processes. These would be the anvil clouds and various other things, funnel clouds and so on, boundary layer status clouds. Over here, you don't. Over here, what you've got is a parameterization of cloud microphysics. You do, of course, still have parameterizations of turbulence and radiative transfer, as I mentioned earlier. But basically, the model grows its own convective clouds or its own stratiform clouds, essentially by solving the differential equations that describe the scales of motion. So this type of model has potential applications, as we've discussed. Eventually, things like simulations of anthropogenic climate change will become possible, not during my lifetime. But we can think about using these models as guides in the development and testing of parameterizations, and perhaps also the development and testing of multi-scale of superparameterizations, as I will discuss in a minute. And they'll be practical for NWP in maybe 10 years or so. So this is actually going to be out there in the world, and it will affect our daily lives before very long. But GCRM climate is still a long ways away, so we need a bridge to get there from where we are now, current climate models, to GCRM climate. And this is, on the one hand, test bed, like the one that's been constructed at the Frontier Project, and on the other hand, superparameterization. It's one way of thinking about superparameterization. It's a way of incorporating some of the strengths of this type of model without actually spending as much computer time. So let's talk about superparameterization. Of course, this has been discussed in the previous lecture and earlier in the week by Wojtek, and so I don't really need to spend much time on it. You know the idea. This is North America, Florida, and here you see an unrealistically large GCM grid box over Georgia. And this thing that looks like a shower curtain hanging inside the box is the two-dimensional cloud resolving model, one horizontal dimension and vertical dimension. And this model is included by using periodic lateral boundary conditions, as Andy mentioned. And it has a particular orientation, which has to be assumed. That's one of the weaknesses of the method. But and the idea, as it says here, was first proposed and tested by Wojtek. So the second name for this thing, which is a bit more formal, is multi-scale modeling framework. This seems to be the name that most people use now. And it's easy to criticize these models because they're two-dimensional, they have periodic boundary conditions, they have horizontal grid spacing of, let's say, 4 kilometers, although we have one with two or one. And they're quite crude, but, compared to what? So here's a column that lists properties of the superparameterization, and here's a column that compares with properties of conventional parameterizations, and here's something to amuse you while I go through this. So we have, in the case of superparameterizations, I just showed you two-dimensional. There's something out there called quasi-3D, which is being tested. I won't talk about today. Conventional parameterizations are one-dimensional. They're called column models for a reason. These models have periodic boundary conditions, which of course is unrealistic. You can watch this thing go out the right side and come back in the left. But in conventional parameterizations, the subject of lateral boundary conditions never even comes up. Shallow convection and turbulence have to be parameterized in the case of superparameterizations, but they have to be parameterized here too. Microphysics is simplified here, but at least you have the input you need to make some progress using what we think we know about microphysics. In the case of conventional parameterizations, the microphysics is usually even simpler and the required input is hopeless. So from this point of view, even though it's easy to criticize these things, they do represent a qualitative advance in several different ways. And as Bjorn says, it's low resolution, but at least it uses the right equations. So I'm going to show you some results now, and I'm going to start with things that relate to deep convection, which most of the talks here have dealt with, and then I'm going to start talking in a few minutes about much shallower cloud type that I've had some affection for 30 years, marine stratocumulus cloud, and show you some results related to that as well. So first I want to talk about results obtained in an ANIP style experiment. I think this term has been used already in the week, but let me remind you, these are calculations in which the sea surface temperature is prescribed to vary month to month over a long period of time, like 20 years, following the actual observed sequence in the real world. So there's no ocean model. The SST changes in the way it was observed to change over a long period of time. And what you do is look to see whether the model responds to these changes in the sea surface temperature in the same way that the real world responded. So it's a way of testing the model. And the period we're going to be looking at here is is September 85 to August 2001, 16 years. We've actually run it out 19 now. And this is the first experiment of its type done with a superparameterized model, which is the superparameterized community atmosphere model. This is the model used in the community climate system model at NCAR. So here we have Wheeler-Colatus diagrams, and they were shown, a Wheeler-Colatus diagram was shown already in the previous talk and earlier in the week, so let me just quickly remind you what you're looking at here. This is the observations in the middle. You're looking at outgoing long wave at the top of the atmosphere, infrared radiation. The horizontal axis is zonal wave number. You're looking at data along the equator. Positive wave number correspond to eastward propagation, negative wave numbers to westward propagation. The vertical axis is frequency. Low frequencies like Madden-Julian are down near the bottom here. And so what you see, of course, is this blob, which has been described multiple times here. That's the MJO. And then you see this strong envelope of Kelvin waves. And the white lines show the phase speeds associated with particular equivalent depths as computed using Matsuno's model. And then over here we have equatorial Rossby waves and so on. Well, this is the conventional camp using deep convection parameterization, stratiform cloud parameterizations, and all the rest of it. I'm going to be talking more about this model here in the next 10 minutes or so. So it's a conventional model, and as you can see, first of all, there is essentially nothing going on at the MJO space and time scales. Notice also that although the model does produce Kelvin waves, they move too fast. The tilt here is too vertical compared to that. And that's an indication that the waves are not feeling the effect of moist processes in essentially reducing the effective static stability so that you get less temperature change per unit vertical motion due to moist processes. The model is not feeling that in the same way that the real world does. These are the results from the same dynamical model in which the conventional parameterizations have simply been removed, delete, 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 and insert instead a cloud-resolving model developed by Murat Karuthanov. And as you can see, there are pretty substantial improvements. First of all, you have a lot of power, if anything, a little bit too much power in the MJO part of the box. And the Kelvin waves have slowed down noticeably compared to the conventional model, and the phase speeds look much more like the observations. Overall, quite a substantial improvement. Of course, this type of thing was first shown by Wojtek in papers in the late 90s, but using a highly simplified general circulation model. This is the CAM. This is a model that's used in IPCC, and a model that has realistic continents and oceans and so on, topography, all the rest of it. So, and also, this is a very long simulation using, as I said, observed sea surface temperatures. So it's sufficiently long that we've got reasonably good statistics even on the lower frequencies. So this is covering old ground, I know. Here's something new, yes, Dave?
Just a quick question, another thing in the canvas, there has been a tendency to have low background variance in the precipitation.
Which has been divided out here.
This has been divided out, how is that in the?
It's definitely much more active. If you wanna look at the output, I'll be happy to make it available. Here's something that I doubt if you've seen before, this is a very recent look at the seasonal change, January through December, of MJO event as seen in the outgoing longwave radiation. Again, using these particular years to calculate the statistics, and years that are characterized as El Nino are shown in red, years that are La Nina are shown in blue, and the ones in the middle are in black. And so the main thing to see is that the observed seasonal cycle shown here in the NOAA data and the simulated seasonal cycle have generally similar shapes with a minimum in the northern summer, a maximum in the northern winter. And the range of variability here is at least comparable in the OLR between the observations and the model. So it's somewhat encouraging, especially the simulated seasonal cycle. Here we're looking at the difference between El Nino states and La Nina states for three things. The precipitable water, this is the total column water vapor. And again, it's a difference. On this side, you see observations of precipitable water from something called NVAP. This is a NASA-based data set. On this side, the multi-scale modeling framework, the SuperCAM. Same kind of thing here for what's now being called the long wave cloud effect, used to be called long wave cloud forcing. It's basically the effects of the clouds on the outgoing longwave radiation. And down here, the corresponding thing in the solar radiation. So what you see is that when an El Nino occurs, there's a very distinct moistening in the central and eastern Pacific near the equator, and a corresponding drying over on the west side of the sort of V-shaped formation. And the model results and the observations actually look very similar. Notice here also a drying over, over Brazil, same kind of thing in the data. You can see similar correspondence here for the long wave and short wave cloud effect. So encouraging, the sorts of results we're getting here are not out of line with results that have been obtained with conventional models. So the main point of this slide is that it's not that the MMF is doing better than a conventional model in this way, but that the MMF is doing as well. Okay? It's the first time this type of calculation has been done. Now I want to zoom in. And this is work that was done in the framework of something called GCSS, the GeoX Cloud System Study. So it's an organized international activity to test models. And what we're looking at here is, there's Baja, okay? So this is North America, and that's New Guinea, I guess, down here. And you're looking at the precipitation. So this is the ITCZ, the Intertropical Convergence Zone rainfall, slightly north of the equator in the eastern central Pacific. These are the observations down here, GPCP. These are results obtained with the conventional CAM, and these are results obtained with the MMF. Now, this is a single summer season, so the statistical significance of the results is not very high, but it is interesting to compare what we've got. One thing you can see is that the precipitation maxima are considerably more intense with the MMF than they are in the standard model. The observations are perhaps somewhere in between. If we look at vertical velocity at 300 millibars, so this is the upper troposphere, you can see in the this is the European Center reanalysis. So this is the closest thing we have to observations of vertical velocity at 300 millibars. And you're seeing a strong upward motion, that's what this blue thing is, slightly north of the equator, again that's the ITCZ, sinking motion a little bit to the south, and more sinking motion up here in the vicinity of the subtropical high. The standard model does produce upward motion there, but considerably less intense than observed. The MMF is making it much stronger and much closer to what's seen. And keep in mind that the
European Center's primary.
I've had this conversation with Kevin Trenberg, okay, I'm well aware of the issues, but it's the closest thing we have. Okay, I'm using what I've got.
Can you articulate, Joe, the objection or the comment on the European Center stuff?
Vertical velocity is not observed. The divergence field is poorly constrained. And in the tropics, much of what is seen is the town's first guest representation of the cabinet. Is that fair, Dave?
It's fair. But this is done in a data assimilation mode, so the model is ingesting measurements of various points.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Maybe I should take this slide out.
No,
all right.
It's
fine.
So ERA 40 was analysis, if you take it at face value, it has a Hadley sound that's increasing this like 25% over that time period, which is totally doable.
What I'm going to do now is talk about the lowly clouds I mentioned before, marine stratocumulus clouds. These are winthy clouds, we often call them. And they live, as I'll show you in a second, in this region, among others, off the California coast, mostly in the summer. And in fact, this line here that you see in each panel is a section along which a more detailed analysis has been done by all of the participating GCSS groups. So this is a picture taken from space, of course, of stratus clouds not too far away from here, a few hundred kilometers offshore. And you're looking down at a cloudy region here, broken by obvious regions of less cloudiness, which seem to have organization on scales of maybe 30 kilometers or so. And Bjorn Stevens has done some very interesting work on this type of mesoscale structure recently. But what I'm going to talk about here is this type of cloud, and it's absolutely beautiful to look at, so that's why I put the picture in. Here are observations from the International Satellite Cloud Climatology Project that show the summertime California stratus depth, as we call it. So here's the cloudiness maximum. You see in excess of 80% out here. Here's Hawaii. So you're seeing less cloudiness out there. Not only is it less cloudy, but it's a different type of cloud. This would be trailing cumulus. And of course, the intertropical convergence zone is down here. So these are the clouds that we're going to be talking about. And as you can see, this thing extends for thousands of kilometers. It's extremely persistent. And as I'll show you in a minute, there are more of these regions around the Earth. Here we go. This is a slide taken from Joel Norris and Conway Leoby at the University of Washington. But the top panel here shows ISCIP data, again, the International Satellite Cloud Climatology Project, for the stratus cloud amount. I realize you probably can't read the legend here, but that's stratus cloud amount. So red means lots of cloud, blue means not very much. And here you see again the California stratus deck. This is actually annual mean, not July, but it shows up even in the annual mean. Here you see similar clouds off the west coast of South America, similar clouds off the west coast of Southern Africa, and even a little bit west of Australia over here, and even a little bit in the North Atlantic. Okay, so very, very prevalent cloud type, and they're important because, as you can see in the lower panel here, they have a tremendous effect on the amount of solar radiation that's absorbed by the Earth, actually by the oceans. So what this shows is the annual net cloud radio forcing as observed from the Earth radiation budget experiment. Net here means that the solar radiation and outgoing infrared radiation are both included. And what you see is, okay, a red blob off California, another one off South America, another one off Southern Africa. These are places where the planet is particularly bright, bright because of these low cloud systems. And in fact, the spatial structure of the net cloud radiative forcing, especially in the tropics and subtropics, is very strongly affected by this type of cloud. And models that fail to produce this type of cloud realistically have very large errors in their simulated sea surface temperature. That is a couple models. So it's a very big problem. Here's some data that was analyzed actually by Wayne Schubert and his group, but it's based on QuickSat data. This is radar scanner data. And you can see a big subtropical high. This is July in California. Big subtropical high feeding the trade winds out here. And this is the large-scale divergence associated with that high and low level. And here's a slide I borrowed from one of Bjorn's papers. This shows observations of the thermodynamic structure of the lower troposphere, this is the lowest kilometer. In this type of cloud system, you have a very strong upward increase of potential temperature at the top, on the order of 10 Kelvin or so, can be even more than that, and a very strong upward decrease of the total water content, basically water vapor, by 90%. So 90%, 10% is moist here as it is here. And the cloud itself tends to be rather shallow, just base that is often well above the sea surface. So this sharp inversion, of course, presents huge problems for representing the vertical structure of the lower troposphere in a numerical model of any kind. And there's some ideas about how to deal with that, but I won't go into that here today. Here's another slide borrowed from Bjorn to show the physical processes at work in this regime. This is the cloud. Again, you're looking at the lowest kilometer or so. And this shows things like large-scale sinking motion. The air as a whole is sinking, and it reaches the cloud top, and it just passes right through, which is extremely weird, because here the air is very dry, here the air is wet and cold. Dry, warm, wet, cold. How does that happen? There's a very strong convergence of upward turbulent fluxes that cools the air and moistens it as it enters across the top of the boundary there. And the turbulence in this layer is driven primarily by radiative cooling of the cloud top. You're making cold bubbles of the cloud top, they sink under the buoyancy force, and you generate turbulence that, at least during the night, can extend down to the sea surface and actually scour water off the ocean and lift it up and feed the cloud. So these things are sort of self-sustaining. Once you produce a cloud layer like this, it can feed itself, at least at night, by coupling to the ocean through this turbulence that's driven by the radiative cooling of the cloud top. It's really very beautiful the way it works. This is just to show some simulations of the turbulence. I think I'm going to skip over this, it's too much detail, but the main point is that they're very interesting, rich vertical structures of turbulent statistics of various kinds. Again, I don't want to go through that here. But this essentially shows what's going on down in the cloud layer. So here's the variance of the vertical velocity, and here's the third moment. Notice the third moment is negative in and slightly below the cloud layer. Now, there's something called the Klein line. This is named for a guy named Steve Klein. And the figure I'm showing you here is taken from a paper by Klein and Hartman. Steve's PhD thesis at the University of Washington some years ago. And what this shows is, first of all, along the horizontal axis, a measure of the static stability of the lower troposphere. It's basically the difference between the potential temperature at 750 millibars and the potential temperature at the sea surface. And along the vertical axis, stratus cloud amount from 20 to 80%. And what you see, of course, is a very strong positive correlation between the two. So what that means is when the lower troposphere is very stable, the cloud amount tends to be higher. When the lower troposphere is less stable, the cloud amount is lower. Now, of course, you wonder why. And the explanation actually can go in two directions. This is the first direction. The presence of this really strong inversion that I showed you inhibits mixing of the cloud with the drier air above, and so it kind of protects the cloud against dilution by the dry air. So it's possible to have a high cloud amount when the static stability is strong. The other part of the explanation is when the cloud is present, you get this strong radiative cooling, and that cools the marine layer. You get the strong reflection of solar radiation that helps the ocean to be cooled. So having the cloud helps to increase the static stability. Having the large static stability helps to maintain the cloud. So there's a kind of synergy there. However, the details, especially of this aspect, are rather complicated and controversial, and I won't go into them here. But we can ask now, in the context of modeling, and especially global modeling of this type of cloud system, which, as I mentioned, is a problem, should we think of the Klein line as input or output? And you'll see what I mean. It's a macroscopic relationship. It's a relationship between large-scale average cloud amount, time average cloud amount actually, and time average static stability, which is another macroscopic parameter.
Is this an observational result?
Oh, yeah. Yes, that was an observational result. And it's been reproduced by lots of other people. So I would claim that parameterization should represent implicitly microscopic processes. In other words, they should represent the interactions between microscopic processes and the macroscopic processes that they're coupled to. And so I would claim that the Klein line should be predicted by a model, that is, it should be output from the model, rather than something that is built in directly by assumption. Let me see where I'm going here. This is a complicated diagram that I won't take time to go through here, quarter to 12, but basically this, I'll go through it very quickly. This This is a summary of how these cloud systems and the large scale dynamical systems that they're embedded in, including even the ocean, interact. So the yellow boxes on top are various aspects of the large scale circulation, including the cold water in the ocean. So it's both atmosphere and ocean. Coastal upwelling driven by the subtropical high produces cold water and so on. You can see how the arrows go. Having cold water is good for strong static stability because it means the lower part of the sound is cold. The substance in the high tends to make the air aloft dry. The blue boxes down here represent microphysical and turbulent processes in the cloud. So things like cloud top entrainment and radiatively driven turbulence are here. And then the orange boxes represent radiative effects. And again, I don't really have time to go through this whole thing, but it's a concise summary, but I will admit rather complicated, of what goes on in these apparently innocuous cloud systems that are actually quite important for planning. So making sausage, okay? You don't want to know how it works. These are observations. Again, this is the same thing I showed you before from this skip. So here's the maximum stratocumulus amount of California in the summer. This is the standard CAM. You can see there is a maximum. The shape isn't exactly right, but there's a maximum. And this is an AMIP from, by the way. And this is what you get from the AMIP, from the MMF, the supercomputerized version of the CAM. So which simulation is better?
The bottom one.
Yeah, got simulation is best of all, but after that, I would say this one looks somewhat more realistic. At least you have a nice, strong maximum, about the right numbers, about the right shape, in about the right place, and this doesn't look as good. But let's look a little deeper. How do the two models actually produce marine stratocumulus clouds? Standard CAM does this, and this is taken right off the documentation. So it's kind of long, but I'll read it to you. Cloud is assumed to be located in the model layer below the strongest stability jump between 750 millibars and the surface. Does this sound familiar? If no two layers present a static stability in excess of that number, no cloud is diagnosed. Now, this is basically the climb line, okay? So the empirical relationship, which is very real, between low-level cloudiness and low-level static stability is used as a way to diagnose the presence of low-level cloudiness. So the climb line is built in. Therefore, simulation of the climb line with the model doesn't really mean much. The only way you could fail would be if you didn't get any low cloud and you didn't get any strong static stability in low-level levels. No information here about the moisture kind, but I find amazing. As Dave Berry says, I am not making this up. The SuperCAM basically solves the right equations, as Bjorn says, with low resolution. So it's pretty crude, but the equations that are being solved are two-dimensional versions of, you know, what are solved in LES. Here's a little movie of what the SuperCAM actually does. Now here we see one of the strengths of this approach. You can go inside and see what it's doing. Okay. So this is an animation. You're seeing along that section that I showed you with the thin black line from north east to southwest. These are the trades, basically. And you're seeing, it's going to loop, but you're seeing over a period of a few days in July, low-level stratus cloud being evected into the domain over here and evected across. So the blue, the greenish color is the cloud liquid water. The bluish color is cloud top radiative cooling. Notice that you wouldn't exactly call it cloud top. It's sort of in the upper half of the cloud. Why? Because the vertical resolution isn't very good. So it tends to be in the upper part of the cloud, but it's not exactly what we see in nature. And then for to come back here, the white curves are vertical velocity as predicted by the cloud resolving model. So the solid contours are updrafts and the dashed contours are downdrafts. And you can see when there's more cloud, there's more vertical velocity below the cloud. And in fact, it's being driven by cloud top radiative cooling. So here's a composite, some statistics extracted from that, and you're looking at a mean diurnal cycle, so this is local time, a bunch of days averaged together. The green, again, is the cloud water. You can see it's a bit thinner in the afternoon, a bit thicker at night. That's realistic. The radiative cooling is somewhat stronger at night, weaker during the day. The turbulence, much more active at night, much weaker in the day. All of these things are qualitative. relatively realistic. The lower panel here shows rainfall, that's the green curve. Now, of course, this is very weak, but here in Santa Monica, or down there in Santa Monica in the summer, if you go outside and walk around, as I used to do, it drizzles on your head a little bit. And so this is the weak precipitation falling out of these thin low-level clouds. And the black curve shows the skewness of the vertical velocity, negative values indicating strong downdrafts with weaker rising motion around them. I showed you very quickly earlier, you can miss it, but that's what's observed and also simulated by LES in this type of cloud. So you're seeing what looks at least semi-quantitatively realistic here. Now you could object that the upward moisture flux from the surface in this regime may be actually due to the subgrid of parameterization in the cloud resolving model and not due to the cloud resolving model grid scale quasi-resolved circulations, and the purpose of this slide is to show that's not true. So the different boxes here are different latitudes from, what is that, 35 or 36 degrees north down to 2 degrees north. So the marine stratocumulus regime is somewhere in this part of the diagram, let's say these three boxes. And you're seeing the whole troposphere, so the lower troposphere is this part of the box, the lower part of the box. The dot, which you may not even be able to see here, is the parameterized surface evaporation from the bulk aerodynamic formula model. And the curve that's plotted is the resolve scale part of the upward moisture transport as simulated by the cloud resolving model. And the point of the diagram is that this is in fact a substantial fraction of the total. You may say, well, that's only half of the surface value, but the moisture flux is supposed to be decreasing upward in this region. So it's actually a bit more than half of what you would get at this level. The main point of this diagram is that it is, in fact, the cloud resolving model that's producing these fluxes. Back to the climb line. So we close that loop here. This is the same diagram I showed you before. This is from observations, and this is what comes out of the supercam. So it's only one season. I apologize. I should have 20 seasons combined here, but this is what I have available to me at the moment. What you can see, well, I wouldn't claim that the correlation is very high, but there is at least some tendency for increased cloud amount at higher static stability. And we will pursue this with a larger set of data and try to get better statistics that I can report in the near future, possibly even next week. So back to this, I showed you this exact same slide before. Which simulation is better? Making sausage? Now you know how this was done. Static stability between 750 millibars and the surface, linear relationship with low-level cloudiness, decline line. No information about water vapor being used. This doesn't look anywhere near as good, but you know how this was done. This is a calculation solving the equations of motion on a coarse grid, and I showed you the cloud of liquid water, I showed you the cloud top radiative cooling, I showed you the vertical velocity, and the rest of it, and the Darnell cycle even, and it looks very much like what we see in nature. So I would claim that even though this doesn't look as good, this is a better simulation. So I'm at the end. Concluding remarks. Global cloud resolving models and MMFs make it possible now for cloud observers and GCM developers to compare apples with apples. We have the same sorts of numbers. We can actually talk to each other. So there is now an opportunity to bring these two communities together a little better than we have in the past. And part of that, of course, is an organizational problem. So we're trying to address that as well. When something doesn't look good, doesn't work well, in either a global cloud resolving model or an MMF, we can look inside, in somewhat the manner I just showed you, to see what's going on, see how the simulation compares or fails to compare well with the observations, and perhaps get an understanding for why good. With a conventional parameterization, it's much more difficult to do that because it's hard to make contact with the data. Focused efforts are underway now to develop improved parameterizations of all kinds, but especially microphysics and turbulence and shallow convection for use in cloud resolving models and by extension, superparameterizations. And focused efforts are underway to develop a radically improved second generation MMF, which we may be able to tell you about it in a year or so. The global cloud resolving models are just appearing on the scene, but I would predict that they have a bright future for practical applications even, starting with NWP in 10 years or so, and perhaps longer term for other things like climate simulation, and for helping us to understand what's going on in an MMF or in a model with conventional parameterization.